Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk about this topic about which I know almost nothing. It is, however, exciting to explore other areas of the world than black holes and gravitational systems. So this is just an attempt, and I'm looking forward to knowing what you guys think of it. It is about economic inequalities. The way I put it is there is a big elephant in the room, really. And that's the fact, if you've considered, for instance, the United States, that the richest 400 Americans own as much as the 100 million poorest. So for comparison, here I'm showing on the left the smallest mammal on Earth, and on the right, the largest one that lives on the land. And their mass compares to the wealth of the poorest, to the wealth of the richest. So if it's not clear enough what I mean by this kind of shocking rate of inequality, here I'm showing a demonstration in Paris when the French team of football won the World Cup. That's more than a million people on Champs-Élysées. On the left and on the right, this is we know whom. And the wealth of the guy on the right is equivalent to the accumulated wealth of everybody on the picture on the left-hand side. Now, this is, of course, a topic that economists and sociologists have wanted to study for a long time. And one aspect which they have focused on is the structure of this wealth inequality. So consider the distribution of wealth in a society. For instance, here we have a plot for the United Kingdom in the 90s. On the x-axis is the wealth of a family, a household, and on the y-axis, the number of families in a society that have that given wealth. So it is here shown on logarithmic axes, and you see that there is a power law tail. And this power law tail means that it is referred to as a Pareto tail in the field. This means that there is an abnormously large number of rich people in a given society. So this is a pattern that one sees here in the UK, but it is a more general pattern. And this is the pattern that people have tried to understand and explain in this extensive literature of economics and sociology. So they have focused on the structure of wealth inequalities at a given time. They wanted to understand what is it that determines this tail, this fat power law tail, and in particular, what it is that determines the slope in this diagram, which is the power law exponent. It is not too hard, I think, to understand what is going on, what is driving this structure of the wealth distribution. We live in a society where income has two sources, mostly. One source is work, is labor, and this is additive. If you work twice longer, you get twice more money, typically. And there's another source of income, which is capital returns. And capital returns, on the other hand, are multiplicative. If you make 5% on an investment, the richer you are, the richer you make, the richer you are, and there's obviously a positive feedback here, which leads to inequalities that will accumulate in time. So this is just a description of capitalism. It is part of capitalism, the fact that capital returns are multiplicative. It is an integral part of this wealth distribution, and this is exactly what you're seeing. So why it is that there is a power law tail is not so mysterious, and in fact, you can cook up simple models that will produce just this pattern based on simple assumptions about capital returns. So this is about the structure of the wealth distribution, but there's another aspect to it, which is its dynamics. So there's been a book that's been published recently by a French economist, Thomas Piketty, and in that book, a historical survey of all the data that is accessible was made, and it was found, in particular focusing on, say, Europe and the United States, that inequalities have evolved over time. So here you see the top 10% wealth share in Europe and in the States since the 19th century. It went up until the First World War, and then down, and now it's going up again. One question which is key to address, but has not been addressed much, I think, in the literature, is the non-equilibrium dynamics of those inequalities, focusing on the dynamics rather than on the structure at one given time. So let's try and address this question, which is so critical to the survival of our societies, I would say. Let's consider this wealth distribution as a probability distribution. As physicists, every time we see a probability distribution, we also see entropy. Entropy is a functional of probability distributions that measure their flatness. So consider the statistical entropy of the wealth distribution given by this expression here. Here, W represents the wealth of a household. P of W is the wealth distribution. And W naught is some unit, which might be, if we are talking about household wealth, maybe 10K, maybe 100K. It is an arbitrary wealth unit. Now, this statistical entropy, just like the physical entropy counts the number of states in a system, the statistical entropy for the wealth distribution counts the number of strata in the distribution. So let me define a stratum as a subset of a population that has wealth between W, W naught, and twice W naught. And then twice, and then four times. And then four times, and then eight times, and so on and so forth. So I define this as a stratum in the distribution, and then clearly the statistical entropy counts the number of strata. So if there's a uniform distribution, for instance, between one unit and two units, which you're seeing on the left, then there's one stratum, and what I call the stratification index is just one. On the other hand, if there's a uniform distribution between one and eight units of wealth, then the stratification index is three. So people are familiar with another notion of inequality in the distribution, that's the Gini index. The Gini index is defined in a different way, and what I want to show with this plot here is that the stratification index isn't very different. It is really the same thing. So I've picked three familiar distributions. One is power law, the Pareto one. One is a normal distribution, a Gaussian, and one is log normal. And you see that when the stratification index, the Gini index grows and vice versa. They are really conceptually the same thing. Now, of course, in physics, we know much about entropy and the way entropy evolves out of equilibrium. One thing we know, for instance, is that for an open system, the growth of entropy in time between, say, two equilibrium states is controlled by how much heat is injected into the system and what's the temperature of the contact between the bath and the system. So we have the second law of thermodynamics in this Clausius form. Now, what's interesting about this inequality, one aspect of it, is that it identifies the dynamical causes of entropy growth as just the heat fluxes. So now that's the question I want to ask. What is the equivalent of heat over temperature for economic stratification? What is it that drives the growth of inequalities away from equilibrium? So the tool I'll use to address this question is this famous result in non-equilibrium statistical mechanics called the fluctuation theorem. We heard about it in a recent colloquium by Jeremy England, and I'll just sketch it very briefly as follows. Consider a stochastic process that visits states in time. Let's consider a Markov process for definiteness. So there are states, call them I, and at any given time, the system has a probability distribution over states P of I. Then the stochastic dynamics of this process is controlled by transition rates, gamma of I to J. And just for clarity, what I'm talking about, an example would be the weather today. It might be rainy, it might be sunny, those are the two states. And the transitions between the two states are controlled by transition probabilities, which might be like this. Now, the fluctuation theorem tells us more than what I'm going to say, but in particular, it tells us this. The variation of the entropy of the probability distribution between two times is bounded from below by a quantity that is a functional of paths, which is just determined by the stochastic dynamics. So consider a path visiting states ik, ik plus 1, ik plus 2, and so on, and evaluate the transition rates, the transition probabilities along each of the transitions in the chain, in the path. Form the ratio that you are seeing on the slide, and just sum over all the steps in the path. Now, the right-hand side, averaged overall path, forms a lower bound on the variation of entropy away from equilibrium. Now, this is a bit abstract, and so I want to show you what this does for us in physics. So consider the case of a system that's in contact with a heat bath at a given temperature, and that system has an energy spectrum EI. And the states, well, they are the levels, each level having an energy EI. Now, transitions are possible between all the states here. So this is what I'm showing on the right. And the condition that the system is in contact with a heat bath at a given temperature implies the so-called detailed balance condition, the first line here. So this puts a constraint on the ratio of the forward rate to the backward rate. Indeed, it gives that the log ratio of gamma for the transition probability of going from J to I over the backward transition probability is just the difference in energies between these two states divided by temperature. Now, if you realize that the difference in energy between two states is nothing but the heat received in the transition by the system from the bath, then you see that the inequality, the non-equilibrium inequality that I wrote here, simplifies to the second law of thermodynamics, where on the right-hand side, you have the average heat, average overall path that the system can take, divided by temperature. So this fluctuation theorem is really something that is more abstract than the second law of thermodynamics, but when you apply it to systems that are in contact with a bath, it gives you the second law of thermodynamics. But it gives you more, it's more abstract than this. So let's get back to our issue of societies and their level of inequality and consider to begin the discussion, consider the most simplistic model of a society with different classes. Assume that there are a discrete number of classes in society, as in a caste society. So those are the levels K, which can be 0, 1, 2, and so on. And suppose that at any given time, there is a probability to go up one class, and that probability I denote pi plus. And vice versa, there's also a probability to go down one class, and this I denote pi minus. Now, if I just apply the fluctuation theorem to this particular Markov chain, what I learn is that the variation of the stratification index between two times is larger than the product of two terms. One term is the average variation of k along the process. So this is social mobility, if you'd like, upwards mobility. So this is the term here on the right-hand side. And there's another term that consists of the logarithm of the ratio of the downwards probability to the upwards probability. And this has an interpretation which is neat. It is precariousness. It measures how precarious the state of an individual or household is in this society. This term is positive if the probability to go down one class is larger than the probability to go up. And so what you learn from the fluctuation theorem in this toy model of a social ladder is that what drives inequalities up away from equilibrium is a combination of positive upwards mobility in the presence of precariousness. It is precarious mobility that produces extra entropy and therefore extra inequality in society. So to illustrate this, I've considered here two different initial conditions. And in the first one, which corresponds to the first row here, almost all the individuals are at t equals 0 in the lowest lying class. So this is the dark blue dot. And say 95% of the population is there, and then 5% is evenly distributed among all the other levels. Then what you're seeing here is over repeated realizations of the Markov path, the variation of the class level. So it is mostly positive, as you can see. Sometimes somebody who was actually up went down, and so the variation of the class level was negative. But in fact, most of the times, you get that people go up in this model, just because they all started from the lowest lying class, almost all of them. And so they are more likely to go up than anything else. So this is a case where precariousness, I assume to be positive, because there is a tendency to go down. at every time step, which is stronger than the tendency to go up, and yet there is a positive upwards mobility. So this is a case where precarious times mobility is a positive number, and so it should drive entropy up. And so what you're seeing on this plot here as a function of time for this initial condition is precariousness times upwards mobility. This is the red dots. And the variation of stratification in this society, and those are the blue dots. And so you see that the blue dots, which is entropy growth, is always larger indeed than precarious mobility. Now I consider a different example where the initial condition is such that there is an even distribution of individuals among all the classes. Now, because there is positive precariousness in this society, the probability to go down one class is higher than the probability to go up. And so the variations of the class level over time tend to be negative. There are exceptions, but they are mostly negative. So in this case, the right-hand side of the second law of social ladders is a negative number, and that allows for reductions of inequalities. Indeed, one finds that entropy goes down, and precariousness times mobility also go down, but the inequality is still satisfied, meaning that the variation of entropy or the variation of stratification is always larger than the precariousness mobility term. So that was really a toy model which provides us with the intuition of what it is that I mean by precariousness, but is obviously not realistic enough to teach us much about real societies. And so let's now move on to a slightly more sophisticated model of the same idea. Here I'm considering a stochastic continuous process for the wealth of a household, which I call W at time t. And I'm considering here three contributions to the variation of the wealth of a household over, say, a year or an economic period. One is wages. Wages is deterministic in this model. It is proportional to time. So the longer the economic period, the more wages you get. And so there is a wage rate L. So that is the first term here. Then there's another term which corresponds to capital returns. And like I said, capital returns tend to be multiplicative. And so you get that the variation of wealth is proportional to how much wealth you actually had times a return on investment, an interest rate factor here, which is mostly a mean value R bar, the average interest rate. But there's also a Brownian volatility term, which corresponds to fluctuations of interest rates. So here I'm denoting this dBt, corresponding to a Brownian motion in time. And then there's also a negative term corresponding to consumption. And I assume that consumption is proportional to wealth. So if you're richer, you consume more. If you're poorer, you consume less. So here I've plotted a bunch of representative trajectories for this process for wealth of an individual or of a household as a function of time. And you see that most trajectories, lots of trajectories, really remain pretty low. Those are the normal guy, right? The poor guy that's just never going to make it to become very rich. But there are also very large fluctuations where a household will become super rich over a bunch of generations, and then that might change over time. Now, you can compute the equilibrium distribution for a given value of these parameters. And it is given by this expression here, which you can see on the slide. Note that this distribution has indeed a power law tail, a Pareto tail. Here, raw is the interest rate minus consumption. So it's the effective return rate here. And so you see that different values of the volatility parameter sigma or different values of raw will lead to different tail exponents. But what's interesting, of course, is that the wage rate L doesn't appear in the tail exponent. And so what that tells us, indeed, is that at very large wealth for the richer people, wages don't play any role. Almost all that they get from returns, capital returns, and those are not dependent on the wages. So that's good. That's for the equilibrium distribution, and it provides us with a derivation of that tail exponent that people actually do measure in various societies. But we can apply the second law of thermodynamics inequality again. And in this case, what we get is that the growth of stratification as a function of time is bounded from below by a term which again involves the product of a precariousness term to a flux term, the flux being social mobility. So flux is J here. It is a flux in well space, and you can think of it as upwards mobility. And P now is a precariousness function, which I've plotted here for different values of what Thomas Piketty would call R minus G, the effective return rate. And you see that it has a shape, an interesting shape, which depends on those parameters. And in particular, it changes sign at a threshold wealth given by the wage rate over sigma squared minus rho, sigma being volatility, rho being mean interest rate. So this is interesting because it tells you that if you inject, social investment on the poorest strata of society all up until that critical wealth, that will actually allow inequalities to decrease. But on the other hand, for a redistribution policy that will target anything beyond that critical wealth, where the precariousness function changes sign, will only have to increase inequalities. And so this provides a target for where redistribution should go for inequalities to actually go down. And that target is all the wealth is below the threshold here, L over sigma squared minus rho. So this is interesting, and there's another aspect which is also interesting and corresponds to a question that was asked to me by Thomas Piketty. He said, okay, all of that is interesting, but what I really want to know is timescales away from equilibrium. So suppose that the value of R minus G, G is growth, R is interest rates. That's his way of calling what I call rho. Suppose that that, by fiat, changes from one value to another value suddenly, say because taxation rates suddenly change due to some new policy. Now, how many years will it take for the top 10% to change from this value to that value? Okay, so this is a question of relaxation timescales. Now, in this simple model, it's not too hard to estimate that relaxation timescale, supposing that you start from one equilibrium state and then suddenly one of the parameter values changes. And you find this expression here where psi 1 is a Euler d gamma function. It doesn't matter really because I plotted the function here. And you're seeing it as a function of the tail exponent, the Pareto tail exponent alpha. So what's interesting, I think, in this plot here is the way this relaxation time depends for a given value of the tail exponent on the volatility of investments. So here I've plotted it for sigma squared equals 1% all the way to 10%, those corresponding to increasing volatility of investments. And if you look in the inset here, you see that by going from 5% to 10%, you can change enormously the time scale for relaxation. Supposing that I'm talking here in years, I would just by changing those 5% in the volatility rate, move the relaxation time from 30 years to 60 years. In other words, there is a very strong social effect of volatility, and a slight change of the volatility of return rates can induce very large changes in the relaxation time of the society, of the economy. So this is interesting. And I'm going to my conclusions quickly, so there is time. And I can also provide you with another example of an application of the fluctuation theorem, if there's interest. Otherwise, I'll just conclude here, saying that thermodynamics really is most interesting when applied away from equilibrium, rather than at equilibrium. There is indeed an analog of the second law of thermodynamics that holds for the wealth distribution. And this second law displays precariousness as a key factor. Now, I've looked at the literature about inequalities a little bit, not much because it's huge, but I've never ever read anything that related inequalities with stochasticity or precariousness. Yet in this formalism, it appears pretty clear that precariousness is a key factor that drives the growth of inequalities away from equilibrium. Furthermore, you can estimate timescales, and you find that volatility is pretty important in setting up the relaxation time of a society. Of course, this is not an economic theory. Maybe this can be turned into a proper economic theory. Maybe not. In any case, I'm very curious to know what you guys think and whether you think it has a potential of being really useful. I don't know, and I'm curious to know. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Leave us 15 minutes for questions.
What do you mean here by turn this into a proper economic theory? What would turning it into that mean? What would it do? And what's the change that you need?
I'm not sure. That would take using data to parameterize the model in the first place. I haven't done that. I don't know what value I should give to R bar. Those are probably functions of wealth. Here I just took one taxation rate, if you'd like, that's pretty much uniform. It would have to be adjusted to the wealth because taxation rates are different at different levels. And also, I'd like to know if precariousness can be turned into something that's measurable or at least relevant to economic data, and I don't know. So that, I think, is the main thing to do. Look at the data, see if this is indeed matching with some of the patterns that are being seen, and whether it helps actually, it is actually useful to consider this critical wealth that I described, and the timescales, whether they are realistic. I don't know any of that.
So I have a comment related to what Dadi asks, which is there are obvious respects in which, I mean, the model is quite interesting, I think, but there are obvious respects in which it's missing something that's present in the real world, which is cooperation among large groups of people, one way or another, mm-hmm. either indirectly, if the very wealthy people get the government, for example, to break a strike by passing a law that certain people
for
have
sure.
to go back, as it happened quite recently in Europe in several cases, or conversely, if the people get together and make a union and collectively try to improve their conditions one way or another, or the conditions of society. I don't see that here because it seems to be just individual isolated households responding to some sort of social background conditions. Mm-hmm. So do you see any prospect for including that kind of activity? Because, I mean, we've seen in the past few years dramatic increases in inequality, and a lot of them are related precisely to those kind of effects.
Yeah, this is obviously a very deep question. I'll just give you a sketch of another way the fluctuation theorem can be useful that relates to cooperation or lack of cooperation among individuals. And that would be a different kind of a Markov chain to which I will apply the fluctuation theorem. So suppose that instead of focusing on the wealth of one individual, W, suppose that I consider a society of N agents, and for each one of them, I consider the fraction between that agent's wealth and the total wealth. And I call this the wealth fraction phi N. So it's a different kind of a variable, but for this one also, it also defines a probability distribution, and so there is an inequality index that is based on those wealth fractions. This is called the Thiel index, and it is defined as a functional of all those wealth fractions as log n minus the Shannon entropy of the wealth fractions. Log n is really the maximal possible entropy that can be in the system, and this is the empirical entropy of a system. Now you see that this is zero where everybody has the same wealth fraction, so this is perfect equality. Otherwise, it is a positive number. Now, I can consider a model where the agents instead of just being individually gaining wealth through some stochastic process, will exchange money at some rates that are fixed, JNM and JMN. So instead of being a model of stochastic income, it's a model of stochastic trade, if you'd like. Okay? I don't know if this is really going in the direction, but I'm just giving you an example of a different way the same kind of ideas can be applied that involve interactions among individuals. That's all I'm pretending to show you here. And so here, you can apply the fluctuation theorem again and now get an upper bound instead of a lower bound because of this minus sign here on the variation of the Thiel index as a function of time. And you find that the upper bound is the expected value of the sum over jumps, over exchanges, over trades, let's say, of the bias of a trade, averaged over all possible histories of the system, where the bias of a trade is B N K N K plus 1 is again the logarithm of J N K N K plus 1 over J N K plus 1 N K. So in other words, those biases are non-zero when one agent gives more than she takes. So there is theft going on in this network. Okay, so in the presence of theft in the stochastic trade network, you find that there is also a relationship that constrains the growth of inequalities in this sense here, which is used by economists. And there you learn really basically that the growth of Thiel inequality index can never be more than the number of unreciprocated trades, biased trades in this exchange model. So the reason why I explain this is because I just want to make the case that the fluctuation theorem is really a tool that applies to all sorts of different Markov chains, which consider different aspects of the problem. One was stochastic income. Here I looked at stochastic trade, and I hope that, and I think that there are ways to use those ideas in different ways. So this is not really, like I said, addressing your question because it's a deep question about modeling forces within a society, political influence, and so on. So I fully agree with this. I just wanted to say once again that it is not just about income, it's about stochasticity. And so this is really a relationship between stochasticity and inequalities in different senses, in the sense of stratification, in the sense of the Thiel index, and so on and so forth.
Any more questions?
I guess we should probably go on about this at length away, but do you see the goal of doing something like this, of doing econophysics, as just helping economists do what they do better? Namely, you know, try and prolong capitalism, or do you see it as something that can be used by people outside of the mainstream as like tools for social change?
I don't know. At this point, I'm taking this as a sort of a scientific inquiry, which is about describing processes that are in the world, taking place in the world, just like we do in physics, rather than as an element of a political agenda. People can have different agenda and use tools, the same tools, for different things. You can use the nuclear power to make energy or to kill people. Same here. So this is really a tool. I think of this as a tool to try and describe society as it is, rather than as a political message. On the other hand, I have a comment about the relationship between physics and economics. I am convinced that the very term of econophysics is terrible. I hate it, and the reason why I hate it is because it is the only field I know where the community that studies the field gives the title to the field rather than the object. If you're looking at the physics of biological systems, you might be doing biophysics. And it doesn't really matter who you are. All that matters is that you're looking at physical processes in biological systems. Here, econophysicists are really shooting a bullet in their own feet, to use a French expression, because they are giving the opportunity to economists to say, but this is something different. We don't need to care about it. And that is the status of the field, which is they don't really listen at all, economists, as far as I can tell. There is almost no interaction between the econophysics community, which is really just a branching of physics, and economics as a science. But it's because the physicists, they've been wanting to be bold and study something they don't really know, which is society, without pretending to be economists. And so they said, we are doing econophysics. If you're looking at economic processes, then you're doing economics. And you should really call yourself an economist as well. And then people should compare methods and results. And it should just be part of the same endeavor to look at economics processes in the world, rather than just physicists being bold enough to study something they don't know, but too shy to call themselves economists. So my impression is that there isn't enough discussion and collaboration among different communities, and it is just a mistake on the part of physicists, I think, that just made it possible for economists to just say, oh, but that's not economics, that's econophysics.
Where do the econophysicists publish their papers, usually?
There's a physics journal that has had most of the good econophysics papers. That's Physica A. You can find some of them in PRE as well. But that's it. It never, like I said, it never percolated into economics journals. So they don't read. They don't care. It doesn't really do anything to economics at this stage. It's more like a hobby for physicists than a genuine attempt to address the questions of economics, which it should be.
If I can make a comment just to explain what this talk is doing in this symposium. We had, in the wake of the economic crisis in 2008, 2009, we had a symposium here at Perimeter on the economic crisis as a crisis for the science of economics. And we had econophysicists and economists and financial modelers and all kinds of people. And they didn't agree about much, but the basic consensus was that the standard economic models are inadequate to the task. And the reason why they're inadequate, in a nutshell, is that they have a notion of equilibrium, which they think is borrowed from physics, which is inadequate. And the thing that was said over and over again in that symposium, in the workshop that we had that followed it, is that we need a model of an economy as a dynamical system far from equilibrium. And there are various ideas about how to do that. So maybe we can argue more in the panel discussion about the usefulness and so forth. But just to explain the history and the interest. Okay, other comments, questions? Rafael, I know you want to get the last word in, so.
Thanks for the opportunity to get
that. Exactly on what Lee just said, I wonder if, are you saying that if we assume that this approximately describes reality, then are we close to equilibrium, or are these external parameters kind of varying so quickly that the relaxation doesn't happen?
They are varying. This is the whole point of the fuss about Piketty's book, sort of a proof that inequality levels are not just what they are, but they're actually increasing over decades or even less than decades, which is a short time if you think about it when the observable concerns the whole of society. So it's a global change that's taking place over timescales of just years. So it is changing, and understanding not just what drives structure at equilibrium, but what pushes for changes away from equilibrium and in particular timescales far from equilibrium, this is very much relevant, I think, to the changes we are seeing.
So then can you make some kind of prediction of what equilibrium it will converge to?
No, because like I said, I would need to at least, if I were to focus to this very simplistic model I showed, at least parameterize it properly. And I don't know how to do that yet.
I think there's more to say, but we should go to the coffee break. Rafael, you'll be here for the panel discussion? Okay.
Let's thank Matteo again.